Welcome back to Making Waves. We begin with this update on the Troops Home Fast from July 26, which focuses on the arrest of Medea Benjamin this past week.
This is Scott Berguin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon, with this update on the Troops Home Fast. According to organizers of Troop Home Fast in Washington, D.C. this morning, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki addressed a joint session of Congress during a segment of his speech in which al-Maliki said that Iraqis' ink-stained fingers evidenced their desire for democracy. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace, and Global Exchange, stood up from the gallery and shouted, quote, "Iraqis want the troops to leave. Bring them home now. Listen to the Iraqis," end quote. Benjamin repeated the statement several times before she was forcefully lifted from her seat, handcuffed, and escorted out by Capitol Police. Benjamin was wearing a pink shirt with the statement, "Troops Home Now," written on it. Benjamin, 54, of San Francisco, California, is currently on her 23rd day of a long-term fast for peace called the Troops Home Fast. She is charged with disrupting Congress. Whether Benjamin will receive a simple citation or will be booked to jail is still being determined by Capitol Police. This disruption follows 2 days of requests for a meeting with Prime Minister al-Maliki. Since al-Maliki's arrival in Washington, D.C., women and men who are fasting for peace as part of Code Pink's Troops Home Fast have been trying to arrange a meeting with the Prime Minister and the Iraqi embassy. Fasters have been waiting for a response to a letter requesting a meeting with the Prime Minister to discuss an Iraqi reconciliation plan that includes a timetable for the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Iraq. Benjamin stood outside the Iraqi embassy for the past 2 days waiting for a response to this letter. Yesterday evening, fasters were ordered by police to clear the sidewalk in front of the embassy in preparation for al-Maliki's arrival. 5 fasters refused to leave, thus risking arrest. The Iraqi ambassador spoke with Benjamin by cell phone and asked that she and the fasters move aside in exchange for the possibility that she and peace mom Cindy Sheehan would get a personal audience with al-Maliki during the evening reception. Sheehan and Benjamin also agreed to break their fast if granted a meeting with the prime minister. He promised to call should any challenge arise and this not be possible. However, Benjamin was denied entry to the embassy that evening and waited for an hour outside, where she watched the prime minister arrive and leave without acknowledgement of their agreement. After witnessing Benjamin's disruption, Maxine Waters, member of Congress and chair of the Out of Iraq Caucus, stated, quote, "We are going to witness more and more public outrage as the violence in Iraq escalates in this ongoing occupation," end quote. Benjamin's public statement is in line with recent polls from Iraq saying that only 1% of Iraqis trust U.S. forces with their security. Despite these numbers, Prime Minister al-Maliki is in Washington to request additional U.S. troops in Baghdad. Also, in opposition to public opinion in both Iraq and in the U.S., the Bush administration has rejected and gutted the peace plan proposed by the Iraqi government. Iraqi blogger and analyst Raed Jarar of Global Exchange and Foreign Policy in Focus, who is also participating in the Troops Home Fast, said, quote, "Medea Benjamin is speaking on behalf of the overwhelming majority of the Iraqis and the Iraqi parliament who want the troops out of Iraq," end quote. A recent world public poll shows that 87% of Iraqis want a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. You can get more information on Troops Home Fast at troopshomefast.org. This has been Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Talk to you next time.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You're free, and freedom is beautiful. And, you know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
Just the fight that is against the war. Start Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of peace.
Was Big Lies by Dumb Presidents. You're listening to Making Waves. We now bring you this analysis by Steve Diamond of recent news in Israel's invasion of Lebanon.
And now we have another addition to my monthly column on nhindymedia.org. They made me kill the civilians. A common recent refrain from Israel's justifiers is that their continuous bombing throughout Lebanon and its resulting killing of many hundreds of civilians warrants some diplomatic hand-wringing, but is in no way Israel's fault. They propose that the location of Hezbollah's offices in urban areas amounts to using the civilian population of Lebanon as human shields. Hezbollah is an official political party in Lebanon's government and runs extensive social programs in addition to its military activities. Its purpose includes representing and serving the civilian population. Yet we are to somehow take seriously the idea that Hezbollah should have anticipated Israel's desire to blow them up, disbanded their political and social programs, and walked out into the desert to be honorably and conveniently blown up by the Israeli Air Force. Of course, that is the root of the problem Israel has with the Arabs. Some of them fail to do exactly what they're ordered to by Israel, so they need to be forced off their land, imprisoned, and/or killed. However, Israel itself has policies that amount to using its population as human shields. Tax breaks and other incentives encourage more and more Jewish settlers to occupy Arab land, necessitating their protection by the Israeli occupation forces. Mandatory conscription in Israel seeks to militarize and propagandize the entire Israeli population, making nearly every citizen a soldier in reserve. Some might argue that random acts of violence against Israel can hardly fail to hit a military target of some form. They use the word terrorist to turn off our brains and justify every excess and atrocity as the fault of those people being exterminated. What will Israel have to do for the world to say it has gone too far? By Israel's current arguments, starting their own Holocaust against the Arabs can be justified. What actual limits exist for a country that can get away with invading another in the name of self-defense? For all we know, it may have already begun. In fact, Israel has just declared everyone in South Lebanon a terrorist and plans to kill them all with even more massive bombing from the air. Unknown thousands of Lebanese civilians still either lack the means of leaving the area, particularly after Israel bombed the roads, bridges, and airport, or refuse to be driven from their homes. Imagine if the United States were to reinvade Vietnam, only this time we first declared that we considered every man, woman, and child to be a terrorist, so we planned to carpet bomb the entire country in order to exterminate everyone there. This is basically what Israel has just declared regarding South Lebanon, which was their Vietnam. At first, Israel decided to invade Lebanon with ground forces, which is the only way to at all minimize the killing of civilians. But due to the unanticipated strength and determination of Hezbollah to repel the Israeli onslaught, they've changed their minds and decided that they'd rather kill a lot of Lebanese civilians than withstand the death of any more Israeli occupation soldiers. They think the political price of genocide is worth paying and that the global community will not force them to stop. In fact, we're rushing them more high-tech bombs to do it.
That was Steve Diamond with commentary and analysis of recent events in Israel's invasion of Lebanon. And here is a remix from the album When I Woke by Rusted Root.
Sky, do you want to run to a future left behind? I remember asking why there lies aggression, separation with the shit below. Power plays while the people die. Let it burn. Protect us from this cruel sun. Let it rain, and protect. protect us from this cruel sun. Open up your eyes, Philibert. Open up your eyes, and let the child. Liberation, friendship, and love. Power plays while the people die. I remember asking why.
That was a remix of When I Woke by Rusted Root. You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Venice with the Institute for Policy Studies, who reviews the chronology of events that led to Israel's attack on Lebanon and the U.S. role in the conflict. Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, who examines Bush's rationale for his signing statements and the danger the practice poses to American democracy. And Esther Kaplan, author of the book With God on Their Side, who discusses President Bush's recent veto of stem cell research legislation and the Christian fundamentalist movement's growing influence on U.S. public policy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ethiopia has intervened in neighboring Somalia by sending troops and vehicles to defend the weak United Nations-recognized interim government based in the town of Baidoa. The interim government is in a tense standoff with the Union of Islamic Courts, which controls Mogadishu and most of southern Somalia. Responding to the presence of Ethiopian troops, Islamists rallied over 3,000 people in a stadium in Mogadishu on July the 24th. Muslim clerics blasted Ethiopia, a longtime rival for dominance in the Horn of Africa. A hardliner cleric, Sheikh Ahmed Kare, told supporters, "Those supporting Ethiopian intervention are violating the dignity of Somalia and acting against Islam." Ethiopian officials responded to the harsh words by pledging to crush the Islamist movement, which it considers a threat. Somalia has been without an effective central government since 1991. Mostly Christian Ethiopia and predominantly Muslim Somalia went to war against each other in 1964 and 1977. International observers fear a civil war could break out as soon as Islamic forces close in on the headquarters of the interim government. On Sunday, July the 16th, A reported 1.5 million Mexicans rallied in the main square of the capital city in support of the leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, despite a claim of victory by the National Action Party or PAN candidate Felipe Calderón. López Obrador of the Party of the Democratic Revolution, or PRD, has filed challenges to the vote totals in more than 50,000 of Mexico's 130,000 polling places and is demanding a vote-by-vote recount. In addition to Obrador's claims to have extensive evidence to back up charges of fraud and vote tampering, other events prior to the elections may have had considerable effect on vote totals. According to the Madison Capital Times, questionable contract with the U.S. data firm ChoicePoint was revealed by one Mexican newspaper. Also, earlier visit by political consultant Dick Morris was followed by a vicious negative ad campaign linking Obrador to Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. Other journalists exposed links between Calderon's brother-in-law's data firm and the IFE, the Federal Election Commission, which counted the votes and admitted that 2 million paper ballots had not been counted in the preliminary tally. On election weekend, the PRD's webpage was hacked and two PRD poll watchers murdered. Thousands of López Obrador supporters have kept vigils at the 300 government offices where ballots are being stored to prevent tampering. Mexico's Electoral Court has until August the 31st to rule on challenges to the election and until September the 6th to declare a new president. Former Christian Coalition Director Ralph Reed lost his primary bid to be the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Georgia on July the 18th. He lost by 12 points to a little-known state senator. Reed, who has close ties to convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff, saw his political ambitions sink due to his association with the ethics scandal in Washington, D.C. In January, Abramoff pled guilty to charges of fraud, tax evasion and bribery. The FBI is now investigating the lobbyist's links to a number of congressional Republicans, including Ohio Congressman Bob Ney. During the primary campaign between Reed and State Senator Casey Cagle, Campaign Money Watch, a spin-off of Public Campaign, spent $100,000 on TV and radio ads linking Reed to the Abramoff scandal. Reed was the recipient of funds channeled by Abramoff from wealthy donors to support casino gambling and also aided corporations in exploiting sweatshop labor in the Mariana Islands. Beside Ohio's Bob Ney, other Republicans tied to the Abramoff scandal include Congressman Richard Pombo of California and Montana Senator Conrad Burns. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As Israel's military offensive against Lebanon entered its third week, nearly 400 Lebanese have been killed, most of them civilians, with more than 1,500 wounded and an estimated 800,000 displaced. 41 Israelis have been killed in the conflict thus far, with more than 300 civilians wounded. Many of the casualties in Israel have resulted from missiles fired into northern Israel by the Hezbollah militia. Jan Egeland, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief, condemned the devastation caused by Israeli airstrikes in Beirut, saying Israel's disproportionate response was a violation of international humanitarian law. Both the U.S. and Israel have rejected a ceasefire in an apparent effort to give the Israeli army more time to degrade Hezbollah's offensive capability. Rejection of a ceasefire angered many in the Arab world, especially after it was learned that the Bush administration had rushed a shipment of precision bombs to Israel in the early days of the offensive. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice received an angry reception when she made a brief visit to Beirut on July 24th, where she heard demands from Lebanese officials for an immediate ceasefire. Discussions about establishing an international force as a buffer between Hezbollah and Israeli forces in southern Lebanon have recently begun. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the chronology of events beyond the July 12th capture of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah that led to the current conflict in Lebanon.
I think overwhelmingly people in the United States believe that the sequence was Hezbollah crossed the border, captured a couple of soldiers, Israel tried to get them back and failed, and Hezbollah began to fire rockets into Israeli cities. And it was in self-defense against those raids that Israel began to attack civilian targets in Lebanon. That's not how it happened. The actual sequence, and it's actually been described correctly in the New York Times, but I'm afraid that it hasn't penetrated popular understanding. What actually happened was, the first thing was indeed the Hezbollah raid. I'll come back in a minute to the international law side of it, but that was the first thing. Israel tried to get its soldiers back and failed. At that point, it was simply a border clash, as has happened so many times before on that border and on borders all around the world. Border skirmishes are not wars. Border skirmishes are border skirmishes. They only become a war if one or the other party wants to make them a war. That's what happened here. Because as soon as Israel failed to get back its soldier, that's when it attacked civilian areas in Lebanon, starting with the international airport and the bridges in South Lebanon. That's what led to this war. It was only after those Israeli attacks, particularly on the airport, the attacks against civilians, that the Hezbollah began to fire their rockets into Israeli cities, which is clearly also a violation of international law and should be condemned, in my view. But the sequence of events did not start with Hezbollah rocket fire into Israeli cities. That only followed the Israeli attacks. Now, even the UN officials, including Kofi Annan, who have been so cautious and so reluctant to challenge the U.S. version of events, have all said that this was excessive, disproportionate, and unacceptable. So it's unacceptable on a whole host of levels, legal and moral. That's where we stand today. International law is simply being ignored here.
The Bush administration has made a very obvious decision to support the Israeli Defense Force offensive in Gaza and Lebanon. They have certainly stonewalled the idea of any kind of ceasefire. What is the political calculation behind the idea that the civilian death toll and rising anger in the Arab and Muslim world will be worth the price in the long run?
Well, first of all, the Israelis made the decision very early on, and they made it public. They announced a week ago, last Sunday, in a cabinet, an Israeli cabinet communique, that, and the term they used was the low-key was their term, that the low-key international response has given them military flexibility. So they made a calculation that they were being allowed to go forward. And, of course, their international public opinion is solely that of the United States. No other country's view matters. And when the U.S. said, go for it, we will not only not say anything, but we will send you emergency jet fuel, we'll send you expedited stocks of bombs, you go for it, you have our full backing, and oh, by the way, we agree with you, we are against a ceasefire. That's all the political credibility that Israel needed. And that was their basis for deciding that it was not worth whatever loss of moral anything they might have ever had. So that's, I think, the first part of it. From the vantage point of the U.S., the issue is, I think, very clearly a strategic one. It isn't only about backing up an ally. It's because the Israeli strategy here, which is to wipe out all semblance of potential, let alone real, resistance to their region-wide domination. It matches exactly what the U.S. is trying to do on a global level and imposing their will using force in the Middle East, starting with the Iraq War. It was really the Iraq War that set the stage for this war. And the strategic basis of it, the San Francisco Chronicle had a long article quoting a number of Israeli officials, acknowledging that this was a strategy that had been put together perhaps as much as 4 years ago, but certainly it was finished within about the last 2 years and has been on the shelf waiting for an opportune moment. That strategy is rooted in the same position that was taken in 1996 when a group of neocons from the U.S. went to Israel at the request of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was then running for prime minister, and they prepared a strategic plan for him. It was a paper called Making a Clean Break, Defending the Realm. And that paper called for the emergence in Israel of a new kind of foreign policy, where negotiations would be abandoned, Israel's neighbors would be informed in no uncertain terms that from now on, military force and not diplomacy was going to be the name of the game. And in that context, they were going to move to militarize the region, wipe out all resistance. That's really what this is all about. That's why they are opposed to a ceasefire. The horror of it, having our government officials say, we don't want a ceasefire, it's not time yet. And you want to shake them and say, what time is right? How many more children have to die? Do 17 more children have to die? Do 6 more children and 17 adults have to die before it will be the right time? Because what we're looking at here, again, is a strategic question for the United States, where that paper, the Clean Break paper, matches on a regional level what the global plan is of a paper prepared by that same group of neocons a few years earlier called the Project for the New American Century.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her latest book is titled Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. On July 23rd, a bipartisan panel of the American Bar Association issued a report declaring that President George W. Bush's use of signing statements is unconstitutional. In the 5.5 years of his presidency, Bush has issued more than 800 statements that he will not enforce selected provisions of bills that he signed. The extent of this practice under Bush came to light April 30th of this year when a Boston Globe reporter, Charlie Savage, cataloged all of the president's signing statements. The best known is probably his statement that he would not enforce the ban on torture passed by Congress earlier this year. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association. He convened the panel, which unanimously supported 4 recommendations for corrective action that will be taken up at the ABA's convention in Hawaii August 7th and 8th. Greco says he's confident the entire organization will embrace the recommendations. Greco discusses Bush's rationales for his signing statements and the danger the practice poses to American democracy.
The theme of all those statements was to indicate the president's intention not to enforce 800 now provisions of law that Congress has enacted because he thinks that the laws are either unconstitutional or they interfere with his powers. Since President Reagan, the last 25 years, we've had presidents who from time to time have attached statements like this. And one or two of them has did what this president is doing, which is to say, I'm not going to enforce this. But President Bush has done it 800 times, and in almost all of these instances, he says, I am taking a bookmark here to let you know that I may not enforce these laws, or I will not enforce these laws. So what's happened now is that this has become a tool for the executive to take more power that the founders of our country reserved for 3 branches. And there are a lot of us who think that there's no reason why we have to overturn what has seen us through this country for 2 centuries because the president wants to be both Congress and the judiciary and the Supreme Court, as well as president. That's what's going on here. It's the checks and balances among the 3 branches that is at stake.
Remind us of our American civics. What happens when a bill is passed by Congress and reaches the president?
He's only given 2 choices under the Constitution when Congress has sent him a bill that has just been enacted. Choice number 1 is to sign that bill, approve it, enforce it. Choice number 2 is if you don't like the bill, veto it and send it back to Congress. And Congress can then look at your concerns and either modify that bill before passing it again, or Congress has the authority to say, Mr. President, we disagree with you, and by a 2-thirds vote, we're going to override your veto. That's what the president is denying Congress the right to do, the right to override a veto, because he's not vetoing. He's come up with another way, kind of a stealth veto. He says, I'm not going to veto it, but I'm not going to enforce it. So there you are. And now we're creating a crisis. The fact is that most Americans are very worried about seeing the separation of powers and the checks and balances destroyed.
Michael Greco, this 11-member panel that came up with this unanimous report includes Democrats and Republicans and people who have served in all three branches of government.
These are Americans who love and cherish our country, and they're recommending things to the president and the Congress to get us back on track. I think the more people understand, really understand what's at stake here, they will become upset. What we're really about here is trying to preserve American values. And if we don't stop it right now, this will become precedent for the next president to say, well, my predecessor did it 800 times and no one complained about it. I'm going to do it too. That's the dangerous slope that we're on.
The panel came up with four recommendations. The first two are for the president, that he communicate his concerns as bills move through Congress, not after the bills are passed, and that he either approve a bill in toto or veto a bill in toto and send it back to Congress for the chance to override the veto, which is how things are supposed to work. The third recommendation urges Congress to pass a law that requires the president to submit to Congress official copies of any signing statements, which must explain the reasons for the signing statements. And you've suggested that the fourth recommendation is the most important of all. What is that one?
We say Congress enact a law that would enable the branches of government to do their role. Give the president, give Congress, give other interested parties the right of judicial review so that the third branch, the judicial branch, can weigh in on what this impasse is between the president and Congress. So these are issues that the American Bar Association just feels an obligation to address because they affect the very fabric of our freedoms in this country and the rights of American people.
That was Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association. To contact the ABA, call 1-800-285-2221. Or to read the report, visit the group's website at www.abanet.org. The Republican Party has in recent years come to increasingly rely on its conservative Christian fundamentalist base to turn out votes in critical elections. The GOP's ability to mobilize Christian right voters on issues such as abortion, gay marriage, and stem cell research is credited with victories in presidential, congressional, and statewide races. Many political observers believe that Christian conservatives now virtually dictate GOP and hence national public policy. When the U.S. Senate joined the House in approving the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act, President Bush, for the first time in his presidency, vetoed the measure. Neither the House or Senate had enough votes to override the veto. The legislation would have expanded federal funding for human embryonic stem cell research by developing new stem cell lines from embryos used in fertility treatments and destined to be discarded. The president's veto was a setback for potential cures for diseases such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and spinal injuries that affect millions of people in the U.S. and abroad. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow initially said that Mr. Bush believed stem cell research amounted to murder, but later corrected himself by asserting the president opposed using federal funds for such research because it involves a destruction of human life. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Esther Kaplan, author of the book With God on Their Side, who discusses President Bush's veto of stem cell research and the Christian fundamentalist movement's growing influence on U.S. public policy.
The stem cell issue, for whatever reason, was handplucked by George Bush and by Karl Rove as the area where he was going to draw his line in the sand and exhibit his true commitment to the pro-life cause. And as people may remember, the first several months of his presidency were not going very well, and his approval ratings were really sliding. This is, of course, pre-911 reality. And one of his only national addresses that he made during that period was about stem cell research, and that was when he announced his initial policy, which was the limited number of stem cells that have already been cultivated in scientific labs as of the day he made this speech would be continue to be available for research, and could researchers could apply for federal funding if they were researching on those particular lines, but that no other embryonic stem cells could be harvested. And that's been the status quo. What it's meant is, in this really dynamic field that was more or less invented by American scientists, most of the cutting-edge research has to happen outside of the country, and academic institutions have been very chary of beginning to set up labs to do this kind of research, because when you're doing this kind of basic science research, NIH funding, federal funding, is really the name of the game.
What does public opinion look like on this issue, Esther? From my reading of it, an overwhelming number of Americans want stem cell research to go forward with government funding to, in the future, come up with some possible cures and treatments for, you know, some horrendous diseases like diabetes and Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis and a whole host of other diseases that affects someone in all of our families.
This is a new issue. I mean, there are parallels here in some ways to the whole debate over same-sex marriage. This is a new issue for everyone in the world, certainly a new issue for Americans. People have only had a few years to think about what this might mean and how they feel about it. But even back when Bush put his first policy in place back in the summer of 2000, already more than 50% of the country was polling that they supported this federal funding for this kind of research. And now, you know, 6 years later, so much more information out there about the potential for these treatments. Those numbers have risen dramatically. So, he has staked out an unpopular position. Again, I think the sense that I have, and I happened to be at a Christian right gathering last week where this was very clear, that this is really viewed as a character issue. This is by his supporters. This is President Bush saying, I don't care what the opinion polls say. I don't care if it's an unpopular position. I've taken it for moral reasons, and I'm sticking to it. And he knows that with a certain part of his base, this will play very well. Now, that's in the realm of kind of abstract values, I think, to the pro-life movement. On the other side, we have people who are extremely passionate because they have a wife with Parkinson's or a young child with leukemia, or a sibling with a spinal cord injury. And in this particular case, of all the different values issues that are being tossed around out there, I think the people that are standing for science are probably more passionate than the other side on this one.
And Esther, I wanted to ask you about the issue of theocracy. There are many who look at the Christian fundamentalist movement's connection with the Republican Party and wonder what these groups' ultimate goal is, and many see it as plainly to be establishing a theocracy in the United States. Is indeed the Christian fundamentalist movements here hoping that they can one day, maybe in the long distant future, establish a theocracy in America?
Well, it's a minority of the leadership of the Christian right who would say such a thing explicitly. But they're there, and people in great numbers, tens of millions of people in this country, are approaching politics from a black or white, good or evil, moral or immoral viewpoint that doesn't leave much room for debate. It doesn't leave much room for democratic fair play. The implication of policy after policy after policy is that they want to impose their religious beliefs on the country. They somehow believe that this is in keeping with democracy, but of course it really isn't.
That was Esther Kaplan, author of the book With God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalists Trampled Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House. For more information on organizations supporting the constitutional separation between church and state, visit the group People for the American Way at www.pfaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring more current issues pertaining to nuclear power and nuclear weapons. We leave you with this quote from Samuel Adams. It does not require a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen to set brushfires in people's minds.